Proverbs 12:26. The righteous chose their friends carefully, but the way the wicked leads them astray. Proverbs 16:28. A persuasive person stirs up conflict, and gossip separates close friends. Proverbs 17:17. A friend loves at all times, and a brother is born for a time of adversity. Proverbs 18:24. One who has unreliable friends soon comes to ruin, but there's a friend who sticks closer than a brother. Proverbs 22:24-25. Do not make friends with a hot-tempered person. Do not associate with one easily angered, or you may learn their ways and get yourself ensnared. Proverbs 27:9. Perfume and incense bring joy to the heart, and pleasantness of a friend springs from the heart's felt advice. And I'll read now from 1 Samuel 18 and verses 1 to 14. After David had finished talking with Saul, Jonathan became one in the spirit with David, and he loved him as himself. From that day, Saul kept David with him and did not let him return home to his family. And Jonathan made a covenant with David because he loved him as him himself. Jonathan took off the robe he was wearing and gave it to David, along with his tunic and even his sword, his bow and his belt. Whatever mission Saul sent him on, David was so successful that Saul gave him high rank in the army. This pleased all the troops and Saul's officers as well. When the men were returning home after David had killed the Philistine, the women came out from all the towns of Israel to meet King Saul, and singing and dancing with joyful songs, and with timbrels and lyres, they danced and they sang. Saul has slain his thousands, and David his tens of thousands. Saul was very angry. His refrain displeased him greatly. They accredited David with tens of the thousands. He thought, but me with one only thousands? What more can he be but the kingdom? And from that time on, Saul kept a close eye on David. The next day, an evil spirit from God came forcefully onto Saul. He was prophesying in his house while David was playing the lyre, as he usually did. Saul had a spear in his hand, and he held it, saying, on himself I'll pin David to the wall. But David eluded him twice. Saul was afraid of David because of the Lord was with David, but he had departed from Saul. So he sent David away from him and gave him commandment over 1,000 men, and David led the troops in their campaigns. In everything he did, he had great success, but the Lord was with him.
The next Bible reading is from John chapter 15, verses 1 to 17, on page 928 of your pew Bibles. I am the true vine, and my Father is the gardener. He cuts off every branch in me that bears no fruit, while every branch that does bear fruit he prunes, so that it will be even more fruitful. You are already clean because of the word I have spoken to you. Remain in me as I also remain in you. No branch can bear fruit by itself. It must remain in the vine. Neither can you bear fruit unless you remain in me. I am the vine, you are the branches. If you remain in me and I in you, you will bear much fruit. Apart from me, you can do nothing. If you do not remain in me, you are like a branch that is thrown away and withers. Such branches are picked up, thrown into the fire, and burned. If you remain in me and my words remain in you, ask whatever you wish, and it will be done for you. This is to my Father's glory, that you bear much fruit, showing yourselves to be my disciples. As the Father has loved me, so I have loved you. Now remain in my love. If you keep my commands, you will remain in my love. Just as I have kept my Father's commands and remain in his love. I have told you this so that my joy may be in you and that your joy may be complete. My command is this: love each other as I have loved you. Greater love has no one than this, to lay down one's life for one's friends. You are my friends if you do what I command. I no longer call you servants, because a servant does not know his master's business. Instead, I have called you friends, for everything that I learned from my Father, I have made known to you. You did not choose me, but I chose you and appointed you so that you might go and bear fruit, fruit that will last, and so that whatever you ask in my name, the Father will give you. This is my command: love each other. This is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God.
Hi, I'm Nick, if we're yet to meet. Joy to be here opening up the word with you. We're normally in Exodus, but we're having a little one-off to think about friendship. I like to think of it as Friendship Sunday. Doesn't that feel nice? It's the year of spiritual renewal, so throughout the year we've been pausing at various moments to consider gifts that God gives us to deepen us, enrich us in our faith. And I think friendship's a really important one. And as you'll see in a minute, I think particularly pivotal for us. So we're going to learn from David and Jonathan, who are two men from about 1000 BC. So we're learning friendship from the ancient world. And frankly, the ancient world was a harsh place. It was a rough time to live. You're going to go home tonight, hopefully, to a home with a roof and a nice insulation. And you're going to lie down in your soft bed. You might doom scroll through TikTok for a little bit if you're of a certain generation. You might read your paperback book if you're of another. I don't know. But you've got these things that you take for granted, these comforts. The ancient world was not like that. If you were someone who was not privileged, not wealthy, you did not only not have things such as that, you also basically struggled to live. You know, you're thinking about what you've got to do tomorrow. What if it was a 15-hour day in the field that depends upon something outside your control just to survive? We often think of the ancient world, the old world, as quite backward, archaic. We finally made it. Look at our life. I want to suggest that the thing the ancient world has that we do not, and which is so important, is there is a depth of relationship that these people understood that we have lost. And frankly, leaves us, without us even realizing it, relationally bankrupt in a lot of ways. We are the point in life where we have more freedom than any other generation that has ever existed in all of history. I can say that. We have time in our schedule unlike ever before, if we allow for it. We have ability to move around the world. We have tools to connect with other people than all of history combined. And yet, we have used all of that to retreat inwardly, to become more isolated in this awful irony of being more connected and yet more alone than ever before. We have created a culture with unprecedented levels of mental distress and mental health struggles where we have this mind-boggling epidemic of loneliness that sits at the heart of the world that should be more connected than ever before. But like a frog boiling in water. I mean, I've never actually done this, but apparently if you boil a frog slowly, they won't notice that you're killing them. I wonder how much that we're not even aware of how deprived we are of the kind of human connection that we were designed to have, because we're a product of our time. We've just received a way of living and moving through the world that we don't know anything else. And even as Christians, even if we've lived and grown up in the church, even if we read the scriptures, we understand them, we try and live them out, there's still this sense in which we are a product of our time and we lack something essential, even though we don't realize it. Let me give you some stats. They're not fun stats, but they're important stats. 30% of people, 30% of people say they never or rarely feel close to people. Let that sink in. They never, zero, or rarely feel close to another person. Some of you are surprised by that, and some of you are sitting here like, oh yeah, I'm one of the 30%. Particularly in Australia, through various different surveys, but this resource that I'm pulling this from is called Publica. It's a Christian think tank trying to bring data to bear on the political situation from a Christian perspective, so it's really helpful. One in four Australians identify in some way as profoundly lonely. With the greatest generation that feels this weight of loneliness, this really surprised me, those under 25. The second most is the elderly generation. That makes a little more sense. Maybe a little grimly, you start to lose your friends as you get older and you get restricted in what you can do. But that the youngest among us, who tend to seem to be relationally connected, they're the most lonely of all. And if you're thinking, as maybe I did for a little while there, well, a lot of this is we're just discovering what's already been true. We can put numbers to it where we couldn't before. It's not that at all. It's a reality that is recent and is growing. One particular stat that hit me hard was in 2012, the amount of adolescents, those who are in teenagehood, who identified as profoundly lonely were a certain high number, but by 2018, it had doubled. And this sort of stuff is all pre-COVID and all that comes with it. And I want to suggest that even if we're unaware of it, we think we understand friendship, but maybe we don't. What a lovely friendship Sunday, Nick. It's grim, it's difficult, but we need to confront this reality because there is a gift that God would give us in a real picture of friendship in biblical Christianity that I don't think many of us have even tasted. I know that there are a few of us in this room who maybe for whatever reason have come to a place where they really have found that depth of relationship that could be. But I think for the most of us, we haven't. And I'm just going to put myself right out there and say, this is me. This is one of those sermons I didn't want to preach because I knew I'd have to come face to face with, I'm not a great friend. And I don't think I even particularly understand the weight of what could be. But God spoke to me, and I hope he speaks to you too. Because I wonder how much our idea of friendship is warped, even as Christians. We have shallow friendships, don't we? A mile wide, an inch deep. There's this sense in which, like, I know everyone. Oh, you know that person? I know that person. And they know me. And then you sort of have an honest moment in a place of loneliness and you realize, actually, I don't think I know anyone. And I don't think anyone really knows me. It's not only shallow, it's kind of optional, where a friendship is a good relationship, but one that I can opt into when time permits and my life circumstances fit and work, and I can then have time for you, but when they're not, I can pull out. It's a give and a push and pull on my agenda. Or there's a sense in which a friendship that I have, if it's not working for me, you can kind of just tap out of it. Again, the freedom that we've been given also allows for us to make some of those decisions that maybe if you lived in a village in the ancient world, you couldn't cut off a friend because they live three doors down and there's nowhere else to go. Maybe a church, you're like, I don't like that person, I'll go to the other church. Turns out there is no other church. Our freedom is often the place that we actually realize that we have swallowed the pill of worldliness. We think of friendship in transactional terms. How do you assess a good friendship? Usually how it benefits you, right? How it makes you feel. What it contributes to your life. And we would never think of it in terms of transactions. It's relationships, right? But really, what's at the heart of it? How are you helping me? Or making me feel, even? And it's always on our terms. I want to suggest that in seeking to protect ourselves, to help ourselves when it comes to friendship, sometimes by withdrawing, pushing people away, life's busy, life's difficult. We actually do ourselves more harm in the attempt to help ourselves because we can't have the kind of friendship that enriches and deepens our life if we hold people at a distance when it suits us. Just to go a little deeper before we get positive, I promise we'll get somewhere good. I want to ask you, what about our relationship with Jesus? Now, we believe as Christians the incredibly beautiful theology of forgiveness, of restoration, of love, presence of God. And I think we talk about the phrase that we use frequently would be a relationship with God. We've been saved by God for relationship with God. But What kind of relationship do you have with God? And this isn't a place of judgment. This is just to ask some questions of ourselves. What kind of relationship do we have with God? And what does it feel like for you to be in a relationship with God? Because I wonder how much we have an understanding of friendship, like we've just talked about, that actually finds its way into our assessment of who God is and what kind of relationship we have with God. Jesus said, John 15, I no longer call you servants, but I call you friends. And I think most of us are like, yeah, Jesus is my friend. But he's kind of like my friend in that he added me on Facebook and he's friends with 6 billion other people. He's got a few things on his mind, and so he'll listen to me when I pray, but there's this sense in which our idea of friendship is not necessarily the kind of friendship that he actually was offering us, which is actually really good news. But again, I want to ask you if a relationship with God for you doesn't feel close, doesn't feel intimate or rich, why? We all go through difficult patches in life, especially in the spiritual life. We often talk about spiritual dryness or maybe that God feels distant. And I can tell you, if you've been a Christian for a while, you go through that. It's normal. It's biblical. But I wonder even our response to that reveals something. How do we usually deal with the time of distance from God or absence from God if we feel it? Usually we look at someone who's kicking goals and we feel like, what have they got that I don't have? Or we grab our spiritual toolkit and we pull out all the things that we can think of to just bring into our life to try and restart this thing called relationship with God. We start reading our Bible more, we start praying more, we start going to church more, we start serving more. And we start to assess, okay, where are you, God? What are you doing in my life? But what are we really talking about? We're talking about how do I feel, aren't we? What is it? Does it feel like God is near to me? Does it feel like God is close to me? And what kind of feeling are we actually talking about here? I think we're talking about, has God been making me feel good despite the things in my life? Does God make me feel his love or feel his presence? But I think if we had a rational moment, we'd say, well, he still loves me even if I don't feel it. And yet so much of our approach to God is driven by this same sort of thinking of friendship. It's transactional and it is me-centered, isn't it? Well, I say all of this to say there's a gift that we can receive and it's freedom. It's really true freedom. It's the kind of freedom that only comes when you give up what you think is your freedom, right? I mean, Tim Keller said this, I'm sure everyone said this, but what is freedom to a fish? It's not being set free from all the confines of the ocean and thrown up into the air, because it's just going to drown in air and die. What is freedom for humanity? It's not the removal of all limitations and burdens so that I can finally live the life that I'm meant to live. We were made for each other, and we were made for God. And you experience the true beauty of being a human when you find that way. And I want to suggest to you that there's a freedom that you will find in your friendship with Jesus when you let go of the wrong way of thinking about this relationship and let God be in control and enjoy that. And there's a freedom and a beauty to your life that maybe you've been looking for in a lot of different places when we stop thinking about friendship in this shallow, worldly sense, but come into something of greater depth. So quickly, two things we're going to try and do today. I hope that God might give us a conviction for a deeper form of friendship for each other. And I hope that he gives us a conviction for a deeper kind of friendship with Jesus. Two things, simple but not simple. So we're going to look at 2 points even. A deep friendship is committed and deep friendship is intimate. Those are the points. So you got your Bible? Open your Bibles. We're going to look at Samuel's account of David and Jonathan. 1 Samuel 18. Page 245, as you flip, let me read you a C.S. Lewis quote. It wouldn't be a Nick Wood sermon without a C.S. Lewis quote or a Dietrich Bonhoeffer quote. So you got C.S. Lewis tonight. He's the guy who wrote Narnia, a bunch of other brilliant Christian books. He wrote a book called Four Loves, which speaks about the different forms of love in Scripture and in our humanity. Here he talks about friendship. Friendship arises out of mere companionship when two or more of the companions discover that they have in common some insight or interest or even taste which the others do not share, and which till that moment each believed to be his own unique treasure or burden. The typical expression of friendship coming out is something like this. What, you two? I thought I was the only one. Have you ever had that moment? You're sort of either meeting someone new or talking with someone you kind of know. You realize you have this thing in common. You follow the Minnesota Timberwolves and follow the NBA, even though they're a tragic team that will never win a championship, and you remain faithful to them despite that because you're a person of loyalty. Me too, right? Come on, give me something, guys. It's the NBA. It's American basketball. If I find that, I'm just over the moon. You too? I thought I was the only one. We have that in all sorts of things, shared interests and different whatevers, but we also find that in depth of life stuff. You've been through something very similar to what I've been through, and I don't know that I've ever met someone who understands that. Sometimes it's our trauma that bonds us. Maybe it's even in the just the life that you got. You're a non-Christian family and you came to faith later in life and now you're, you know, oh, me too. These are the sorts of things that what C.S. Lewis suggests moves us from what he calls companionship to friendship. Now, pause. That's an important point because I wonder if by calling everything friendship, we call nothing friendship. We sort of suggest if there's a person that I kind of know and they kind of know me, that's friendship. And we refer to all these things as friendship. That has not been the way of the past. C.S. Lewis doesn't say that. He says, you can be a companion with someone. Maybe you're sitting next to someone in church on a Sunday that maybe you've been together for years, and yet they're not a friend in that deeper sense. They're a companion. There's someone involved in your life that you know and knows you, and you walk together, you do church together, and there's parts of your life that you share together. But that's different from friendship. C.S. Lewis would say the friendship piece is not just someone I'm a companion with for whatever reason. It's someone that there's a shared oneness. There's something that binds us together. And of course, we're bound together by Jesus. But even in this friendship, there's something about me and about you that God's just like gifted us to come together in this place of oneness. It's something that you can't be friends with everyone, nor should you be, if we understand what friendship truly is. We love everyone, especially the brothers and sisters. But a friendship relationship has a deeper depth of vulnerability, of commitment, of life together. What does it look like for David and Jonathan? Well, 1 Sam 18. After David had finished talking with Saul, Jonathan became one in spirit with David. That's cool, kind of confusing. But I think he's speaking a bit about what C.S. Lewis has put his finger on, this sense that these two men have found their person that's just sharing something that no one else has shared. And so there's a oneness there. They're both soldiers. They're both privileged to command armies. I mean, we saw David killing tens of thousands of people, right? Jonathan's the same as the son of Saul, the king. They're both very emotional and passionate. Both of them sort of show that in their stories. But I mean, who's David? He's the guy who writes poetry for fun. And the first time Saul tries to kill him, he's playing the lyre. Like he's an emotional dude. He's the guy who's sitting back writing poetry. It's what you'd expect. But so is Jonathan. And frankly, both of them take God seriously. Their whole nation is, you know, following God. But these two men follow God. And so they come together. There's this oneness that they both sense. But notice the language. It says, Jonathan became one in spirit. And this is what I want to suggest to you, that friendship can be born out of this place of you two, me as well, a shared sense of this could be a thing. But that's only where it starts, because friendship requires a deeper commitment. That's the first point. Deep friendship involves commitment. Jonathan made the decision. He took the action that this, you know, relationship that was forming, he said, nah, let's take this seriously. They became one in spirit. It kind of feels a bit, ooh, that's very close, isn't it? One in spirit, what does that mean? All I think it means is, you know the phrase kindred spirits. Do you know what I mean when I say a kindred spirit? So, oh yeah, it's a kindred spirit. He gets it. We're both on the same wavelength, that kind of thing. I think what this is saying is these two kindred spirits have made an active decision to bring their spirits together in a commitment. In a bonded, I'm for you and you're for me kind of relationship. And your spirit is sort of your will and your desire and your pursuit of your life, if you will. What this is saying is suddenly David's spirit is as much Jonathan's spirit and vice versa. When David hurts, Jonathan hurts. When David triumphs, Jonathan triumphs. When David's life goes one way, so does Jonathan's. You know, you can have friends where you're both living separate lives and you occasionally touch point. That's what we mostly do with friendship. This is a moment where these two men have said, no, let's bring our two departing paths into one path. That's huge. Like, really think about that. Think about the closest person in your life that you're not dating or married to. We'll talk about that in a minute. What if you looked them in the eye and said, what if we just joined our lives together? I think they'd be like, dude, we were just getting pizza. It's all good. It's intense. It's really intense. But I wonder if it feels intense because we just don't even have a category for this kind of relationship. This is deep friendship. You can't do this with everyone. Hey, welcome to church. Would you like to form a covenant with me? No, it doesn't work like that. This is the kind of thing you can only do with a couple of people. I'm not going to try and put numbers to it, nor should I try and define it for you. But I think what we're seeing here is the gift that God has given us when we find a kindred spirit and we have the opportunity to walk a life together. Not just kind of live two lives in proximity to one another, but actually bring those lives together. Friendship involves commitment. Verse 3, Jonathan made a covenant with David because he loved him as himself. What's a covenant? A covenant in the ancient world was two different individuals forming a relationship and defining what that relationship looked like. Usually it was a public thing. Here it's not. It's a private thing. It's just Jonathan and David, which is kind of wild because when it's just you and a friend, you don't usually need to do a thing that's official and formal like making a covenant. You would only do it if you had a reason. Why are they doing it? Because they're saying, I'm taking this seriously. I want this relationship to be seriously committed. It's really intense in a way. I just picture this, right? If me and a friend are just standing here, it's just no one else in the room, and I'm just looking him in the eye, you know, eye to eye. My beard's just flowing down because I'm in the ancient world, and I'm just looking this guy in the eye, and I go, hey, I love you. I love you. I am so thankful that God has brought you into my life. My life wouldn't be the same if you weren't in it. And I want to just name it. I want this to be a significant friendship. I want to not just kind of float through life, maybe hanging out together. I want to do this thing called life with you. I think it could look like this. What if we, and talked about it. And then he was like, do you know what? That's a great idea. It's kind of like the year three behind the canteen spit shake. All right, we're in. It's this commitment to one another where we're actually looking each other in the eye. If you've been into any form of dating, it's the uncomfortable moment when you have to define the relationship, but they're willingly choosing to do it. Why? Because there's a gift when you have a friendship where you're able to do this. And if you're a man in the room, this is making you cringe. I'm cringing just talking about it a little. To be able to look another brother in the eye and just bare your soul and emotions. You're like, emotions? I don't even have those. Well, yes, you do. And friendship could be the place where that comes forth. Now, I'm not suggesting we covenant together. This is, again, it's an ancient story with ancient context. What I am suggesting is maybe we take friendship too lightly. Maybe we need just a few. Looks different for all of us. We have different capacity, different needs. A few people where we not only just choose to take the friendship seriously, but maybe even talk about it together. Hey, it's not a really nice phrase, but you're my ride or die guy, you know? Who are you running with is another way to put it, like as you run through life. Who are you, well, walking if you're less athletic? Who are the people that you are joining yourself to? I'm going to ask you, who are your friends right now? Just have a think of to yourself. Who are the friends in your life? Who are the people that you wish were friends in your life? And what could it look like if you really thought about deepening that, taking that a bit more seriously. Proverbs 18:24, one who has unreliable friends soon comes to ruin. Now, unreliable, not bad or crappy friends, just unreliable. You don't know if they'll show up for you, which is a lot of the modern world. Unreliable friend soon comes to ruin. But there is a friend who sticks closer than a brother. Isn't that beautiful? You can't choose your family. You can choose your friends. And the Bible is saying the kind of friendship that you could have is where not only do you get to choose this person, but they might be even closer to you than your family. And that is the kind of friend who brings life and beauty into your life. But commitment is hard. And putting that person in your life is difficult because we've already talked a lot about it tonight. Life is busy. There's so many competing demands. And this is where I think I'm a bad friend often. When I get overwhelmed, I withdraw. And I still love you, but man, I don't have time for you. To have a friendship like this is to say, I actually am going to take this as a significant part of me and put you first. I might drop the ball at work. Because do you know what? I'm not defined by my work. I am defined by my relationships. I'm going to say no to some stuff that I really like doing because actually my life is not my own and I love you. We get this in certain contexts. You can't just do what you want when you want to do it, but to choose this is to choose to embrace some difficulty perhaps. But I think the biblical promise here is to say, what if you had that person where you know that they will always be there and you will always be there too. That you can be as raw and vulnerable as you want. There's no judgment because they're doing the same with you. And as believers, where we can really actually do this thing called life with Jesus in a way that someone can just put their finger on your soul and encourage you, challenge you, help you, pray for you. Anyways, that's friendship is, deep friendship involves commitment. A little bit quicker, deep friendship involves intimacy. You might have noticed the language, it says, verse 1, that Jonathan loved him, David, as himself. We use that phrase from the Bible frequently, love your neighbor as yourself. What we usually mean is the way you love someone is not just to help them occasionally from a distance, but to love them kind of like you would do the things for your own needs, meaning love's a bit sacrificial. That's not even quite capturing what's going on here. Firstly, it's past tense. It's not just talking about hypothetical. It's Jonathan already did it. He, past tense, loved him as himself. What does that mean? These two kindred spirits have become one, and so your needs, David, are my needs, and I love you as much as I love my own life because these two lives have been joined together. Again, I'm getting a little uncomfortable to think of me and another man just having this kind of intimate relationship. But that's what's going on here. And the reason I'm feeling uncomfortable is because our society and our culture hasn't got room, especially for men, to know and experience and express their emotions to other men. But we also don't have a category for the kind of life-on-life relationship that isn't marriage. And I'm going to talk about that in a minute because I think this is so important. But Jonathan loves David as if they actually were kind of one person, which again, it's not to be confused with this marriage picture of Genesis of becoming one flesh, because there's things that are in marriage that are only in marriage. There's certain things that define friendship that overlap, but there is a reality which it just makes sense to biblical relationships where I'm not my own, you are mine and I am yours. What are we as the church? We are the body of Christ. We're one. I'm connected to you as you're connected to me, and that hurts sometimes, and that's a good thing. What does this intimate relationship look like? Well, verse 4, Jonathan took off the robe he was wearing and gave it to David, along with his tunic and even his sword, his bow and his belt. Notice this is after he makes the covenant. So we're back to Nick and his best friend in the church, intimately longing to build a friendship, looking each other in the eyes, dude, I love you. And then we've made our commitment to one another. And what do? I take off my jacket and I put aside my weapons. I wouldn't be carrying weapons in the moment, but I put aside these things. It's an act of vulnerability. I'm being completely exposed before you here. But I think what it's also saying is, here, take these things. They're mine. I want them to be yours because what is mine is yours. suddenly we're back in the marriage territory and I'm getting uncomfortable again. Because isn't that what the marriage thing is? It's you make promises to a person, like a covenant, and you join your lives together, you become one, and what's mine is yours. Isn't that the marriage? Yeah, it is. Why does that make me uncomfortable? Because I think we have taken all of the richness that can be found in deep friendship, imported it into marriage, and made it a marriage thing, not a friendship thing. And so you need to be married if you want to have a person who is unwaveringly committed to you and they won't leave you. You need to be married if you want to have someone you can be intimate with, and we conflate sexual and romantic intimacy with emotional and friendship intimacy, even physical intimacy that's non-sexual. We lump it all together in this thing called marriage, and that's where you find intimacy if you long for it from another person. And you bring all of this together in this one thing. And so friendship is this small, shallow thing over here. Marriage is this wonderful, beautiful thing over here. And so we're left with this place where, one, our marriages, if you're married, suddenly have a weight that they weren't meant to bear. Try put the emotional, relational, physical, and just spiritual even, needs that you can only find as you do life with another person and just heap them on one person and make them carry it, you'll crush them. Anyone who's been married for a minute knows how hard marriage can be. And I wonder if this is part of why it's so hard. We look for so much in this romantic joining that it just makes it so difficult to have that relationship to be healthy. Frankly, I think that's because there are friendship things in marriage that should be in marriage, but should also be in other friendships. I'm married and I've been married for almost 10 years. Man, it's been hard at times, also really good. What do I love about my marriage? I love the best of my marriage. Of course, the things that are particularly marriage-y, like the intimacy of romance and the one fleshness, to put it a little less crassly. And you know, some of those things that come only in marriage, they're good things. But I actually love for the most part because Beck's my best friend. Like, she makes me laugh and I can tell her anything. I know she's not going to judge me. Or if she does judge me, it's because she loves me. And if she does judge me and it's not loving, I can then call her on it because we're committed to each other. You know, like, it's all of these things that actually, that's a friendship thing. And marriage should be a friendship because, again, there are many marriages that are so lonely because they're not friends. And there are many marriages that are thriving. And it's not about the marriagey things, it's about the friendship thing. Why am I talking about all this? Well, I'm talking about all this because, one, if we get marriage wrong and we pursue marriage, it's going to not go well. But two, we've lost friendship. Bring the friendship back, man. You can be married and have this kind of friendship and also have friends that are deep and meaningful as well and intimate and committed. And that's actually a really healthy thing because your spouse is no longer this person that has to be all the things for you all the time. And suddenly you have what God intended in the first place. The real reason I think this is so important is because in all of this, we have elevated marriage in the church to where it should not be. We have put marriage on a pedestal as if it is the relationship that you need to have. Frankly, it is crushing to be a single Christian past your 20s because suddenly the people that you were doing life alongside, even perhaps poorly if we're not doing friendship, they've all retreated into their marriages and left you alone. Or they might be present around, but there's no intimacy or commitment left over for someone to be not married because they're pouring all that into their spouse. That's not the biblical picture of love nor of friendship. And so marriages are suffering. Do you know what? The nuclear family has been like this association that we've placed upon the church for decades. And it's not just because of the whole biblical sexual ethic of a man and a woman being married. It's because we've enshrined the nuclear family as the picture of what it means to be healthy and connected relationship. It's just not true. The church is this place where Paul the Apostle can say, in the ancient world of all places, if you can stay single, you should do it. That's a really good thing to do. Why can he say that and mean it and not be condemning someone to a life of loneliness? Because in the church, you should be single and deeply connected. seen, known, and loved. Not just emotionally from a distance with words, but even physically. It's a known fact that humans tend to like wither when they're deprived of human touch. And we're not talking about romantic touch or sexual touch. We're just talking about human touch. There's a reality in which we need to be hugged and embraced and you know, just even kissed on the cheek or just a hand on the shoulder. There's this need within us to be embraced personally and relationally. And to be single is not to lose that, but to have that because, well, this is what we were made for, friendship. All this to say, if you're single and you're struggling, there's so many reasons why. If you've been married or you are married and you are lonely or you are struggling, it makes sense in a lot of ways. Please know that the Lord sees you, but at the same time, church, everyone here, we've got to change this narrative. Relationships need to be biblically defined, not culturally defined with a bit of biblical sprinkled on top. We need to reclaim friendship. And we need to reclaim the kind of love and way of moving through the world with people we aren't married to that brings true connection. Now, oh, and also, if you're not married, it's okay to stay not married. Don't pursue marriage for the sake of pursuing. I just got to say that, especially for my young crew around here. Just don't follow the narrative that's not actually the right narrative. You don't need to get married. So what I want you to see, though, is that this sort of deep friendship can and should be intimate. And then we'll wrap up quickly. If you flip over to chapter 20, the end of Saul trying to murder David and a few other attempts at murder ends with Jonathan even testing that to work out, is my father trying to kill you? Yes, he is. This sort of depth of friendship says, even though you're the king, I'm the son about to inherit the whole of the kingdom, I'm going to love my brother who I am one with, even though that means I won't be king and I'm giving it all up. That's the kind of friendship we're talking about. And they're having this moment of parting because they realize David's got to flee if he's going to stay alive. Verse 41, after the boy had gone, David got up from the south side of the stone and bowed down before Jonathan three times. Again, they're private. It's just the two of them. Why would you ever do that? You're hanging out with a friend. Hey, pause. And just get on your knees and start bowing down. Well, he is using his body as a form of humility to honor this brother, this friend, to say, you just gave everything up for me. The love that you've shown me is worthy of my life. I honor you, Jonathan. And I'm about to run away and maybe not see you for a long time. And I just want you to know, I honor you. And I'm not just saying that with my words. I'm saying that with my body. And now that we're about to depart, well, then they, verse 41, kissed each other and wept together. But David wept the most. I kind of love that. The guy who the scripture talks about being the man after God's own heart makes it really important. He was the one crying the most like a baby, all right? If you're worried about being emotional and intimate, look at David, look at Jesus. They kissed each other. It's not a intimate sexual relationship, as scholars have started to speculate about Jonathan and David. I think we speculate that because we're so uncomfortable with a deep friendship between two men. It's not that kind of... It's a New Testament picture where it says, greet each other with a holy kiss. We've lost that. We've lost this sense of even... just greeting someone with a big hug. And, you know, there's a reality in which we sort of like lightly, politely kiss someone when we see them at a party or whatever. But this is like a bit more of like a, you're my brother, come in and give you, you know, big hairy dudes who kill thousands of Philistines just like embracing and kissing each other, right? You know, manliness in the archaic sort of sense does not preclude emotion. They kiss each other, they weep because they are unashamed to be vulnerable. I would normally say this just to men, but I think this is all of us. I think a lot of us are afraid of intimacy, afraid to let our guards down and be seen for maybe who we actually are, or even just to be seen as if we're not all together. If the guy who is the man after God's own heart can do it as a good thing in friendship, we should be willing to do the same, and maybe even that is a tool in the hands of God where we just stop trying to hold it together. Stop trying to be perfect and Let a sister or a brother embrace us in our imperfection and love us in our vulnerability, because that is what deep friendship should look like. I bring all of this to say, finally, that this is just a taste of what friendship is like with Jesus. David is the man after God's own heart. And what you see here is the kind of friend that Jesus suggests he would be to you. John 15, I already said it, but you know, if I no longer call you servants, I call you friends. He's talking about this kind of friendship. He looks upon you. Again, he's sitting in the upper room with his 11 closest friends. One of them's about to kill him or betray him, but he's looking at the 11. And this is what he does with you. It's not a Facebook friend of 6 billion. It's he looks you in the eye. He says, Nick, you're my friend. And what he means is, I'm yours and you're mine. I'm a walk with you. Your needs are my needs. And frankly, you can't do anything to stop me. He could have used this sort of stuff anywhere in the whole of the Bible, but he chose to put this call of friendship in the vine branch thing. Why? Because as much as it's a cool theological thing, it's actually an intimate relational thing. He's saying, hey, brother, hey, sister, you're a branch and I'm the vine, and we are just joined so intimately that you don't even know where the branch ends and the vine begins. We're one. And that's what it means to be my friend. And so this is for me the one thing that God commands of you if you would have a friendship with Jesus. He says, I'm abiding in you, so abide in me. I'm in you. I'm with you. I'm before you. I'm your friend. I'm committed to you. I love you deeply. Nothing can change that. But now your job, if you would have this friendship with me on your side, is not to do the religious things. It's to just rest in me, abide in me, dwell in me, meaning be my friend in this same committed way. And so I want to give you a minute as the band comes up just to reflect. I don't want to tell you what you should think about with this. There's so much to think about, but take a minute. What is God calling you to in your own friendships? Who? How? Do you need to speak to a friend and invite them into a commitment, into depth? What about your relationship with God? What is Jesus speaking to you here? I'll give you 1 minute and then the band will lead us in worship.